Today is August 1st, 2018, as we wrap up our 35th year of radio broadcasting, and next week we start a new year. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, my colleague is Joe King, and podcast of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, also on prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM, 99.5 on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are different. This week, WBAI is in a membership drive. Tonight, we have lined up the following for discussion. New York State revokes approval of Charter's Time Warner cable deal. Well, if that happens, what happens to Spectrum cable customers if Charter does get kicked out of New York State? And New York State's order kicking Spectrum cable out of the state, the action itself is quite radical. We're going to be talking about voting machine vendor who is admitting that they have installed remote access software on state systems. We will cover that Chrome, which is offered by Google, and Firefox, which is offered by Mozilla, is reining in memory-hogging websites. Classic Shell returns as Classic Start, giving Windows 10 users a proper start menu. And on a third try in a comeback bid, Radio Shack partners with Hobbytown to sell electronics in 100 U.S. stores. In our feature segment section of the program, I will be covering the following. The smartwatch is a solution looking for a problem. Another thing I'm going to talk about is, do you really need the next generation smartphone? And Marty Winston will be covering the design of the maintenance-free house is dependent on the geography itself. Last Friday, the New York Public Service Commission officially filed an order saying that Charter had failed to meet a June 18, 2018 deadline for additional passed homes. As a condition of its merger approval in New York State, Charter was required to pass an additional 145,000 unserved and underserved homes and businesses in the state. Charter filed an update on its progress late last year and in June. The NYPSC disqualified over 18,000 passings from that report, claiming that many of the passings were in heavily populated urban areas like New York City, and therefore failed to meet the requirements of new passings. The commission ultimately decided Charter failed to meet the build-out requirement and therefore is looking to revoke Charter's merger agreement with Time Warner Cable in New York. This step is being taken after repeated attempts by the commission through administrative enforcement, which have not resulted in changes to Charter's commitment to meet the requirements of the network expansion condition. And the New York Public Service Commission wrote the following. In the weeks leading up to an election, rhetoric often becomes politically charged. But the fact is that Spectrum has extended the reach of our advanced broadband network to more than 86,000 New York homes and businesses since our merger agreement with the PSC. Our 11,000 diverse and locally based workers who serve millions of customers in the state every day remain focused on delivering faster and better broadband to more New Yorkers as we promise, Charter said in a statement. The commission said it would begin a special proceeding or action in the New York State Supreme Court to seek penalties for Charter's violations. Charter has 30 days to appeal the commission's decision to revoke its agreement to the merger. A Charter spokesman did not respond to requests for further comment. The company has had multiple opportunities to correct these issues and either has not done so or has been openly brazen in its effort to avoid them, the commission said. The Public Service Commission gave the company 2 months to find a new cable provider to replace its operations. What happens to Spectrum cable customers if Charter gets kicked out of New York State? Virtually no one likes their cable company, so it's hard to imagine many tears were shed in New York this weekend over the news that Charter Communications might get kicked out of the state. It's an unusual move. The State Public Service Commission voted to revoke approval for Charter's merger with New York-based Time Warner Cable, which means Charter is effectively banned from doing business in New York, where it operates under the Spectrum brand. The commission said Charter had failed to meet its commitments under the merger, notably to its promise to provide better service to underserved areas. Well, all of this may sound well and good with the action by the Public Service Commission, but what about the more than 2 million customers who rely on Spectrum for their cable, internet, or phone service? Throwing out the provider is tantamount to throwing out the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. We need clarification from the commission about what Spectrum customers can expect. In a nutshell, the commission has ordered Charter to come up with a plan for its own replacement. Per that order, the company has 60 days to file an action plan telling the commission how exactly it will ensure a smooth transition to a successor provider or providers. In the meantime, Charter is required to keep providing service and keep carrying its obligation under state law, all while ensuring that its existing customers experience no interruptions in service during the transition. You're asking a lot of a company, and according to the commission's own finding, has already failed doing what it's supposed to do. And now customers are expected to trust the same company to oversee a smooth and orderly transition to a new provider. Either way, it feels like customers are losing on this one, but then, welcome to the cable business. Charter, for its part, plans to fight last week's order, so it's likely that nothing will change in the short term, and in a statement, the company disputed the argument that it hasn't met its obligation, suggesting instead that the commission's decision was politically motivated. The New York State Public Service Commission voted 3-0 Friday to rescind its 2016 approval of Charter Communications' merger with Time Warner Cable and ordered the company to cease its operation in the state. The commission said Charter, which operates cable television, broadband, and telephone service under the Spectrum brand, has repeatedly failed to meet an important condition of the merger approval, extending its broadband internet service to unserved or underserved areas of the state. The regulators also hit Charter with a $1 million fine on top of the $2 million in fines that they had previously laid on the company for missing deadlines for extending its high-speed internet service to the state's less densely populated areas. The commission ordered Charter to file a plan within 60 days for the orderly transition of its cable franchises throughout the state to another provider or providers. If they can't do the job now, and now you expect them to provide a smooth transition to a successor, you gotta be kidding. The matter, however, very likely could end up in a long court battle. And based on the legal ramifications, it's gonna take time. And it's expected that there'll be tedious negotiations between them. A Syracuse University law professor, Shobha Ghosh, said that the commission may have taken such a drastic step to give Spectrum a kick in the pants to speed up its broadband build-out. If the dispute winds up in court, a judge will have to decide whether the company really has failed to meet its obligation. But even if the court sides with the commission on that point, it would not necessarily order Spectrum out of the state. The court does have some leeway on what the remedy would be, and it could be just a fine. The court could order the company to expedite the expansion and fine it if it fails to do so. This definitely will get the company to move faster. The state and the company could avoid the time and expense of years-long litigation fight by agreeing to have an impartial third party, such as an engineering firm, conduct an audit of the company's build-out progress. Obviously, if Charter hasn't met its obligation, well, they've got to correct it. But just saying you want to throw them out of the state makes no sense. If you're going to kick Charter out, who's going to take over? Charter is there and, well, you have to give them a chance to fix it. Charter is the second largest cable company in the nation, behind only Comcast. In New York, however, Charter is by far the largest, with more than 2 million subscribers to 1,150 communities, including the major upstate metropolitan areas of Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and Albany, and the boroughs of Manhattan, Staten Island, Queens, and parts of Brooklyn. The company was required to reach certain build-out milestones each of the 4 years, but the commission said it had fallen short in each of the first 2 years. In January of this year, Charter filed a progress report saying that it extended its network to over 42,000 homes and businesses, exceeding its required target of 36,000 by December 16th. But in June, the commission disqualified over 18,000 of the passings, saying that they were in areas, the majority of them in densely populated New York City, already served by Charter or another broadband provider. As a result, the commission said the company had again fell short of meeting its requirements and obligations. Charter further angered the commission by continuing to publicly claim that it was meeting the requirements. On June the 26th, the commission accused the company of misleading consumers about the matter and filed a false advertising claim against the company with the Attorney General's office. Hey Joe, this is a very serious matter. What are your thoughts on this?
As usual, Hank, I was taken in by all of the headlines last week. You know, those big headlines about Charter and their merger with Time Warner being turned over, and it's not going to be allowed, and Spectrum is going to go off the air. Those were the headlines. I have finally gotten around to reading the backup to the stories. And what it looks like to me, Hank, is a political move that the state public something commission, public service commission, public something commission, was pressured into saying they were going to withdraw the charter, the ability to run cable, television, radio, frequency, internet, and so on. Well, it looks like, in my opinion, that's all headline. It's not going to happen. It can't happen. There's too much money involved in it. There's too many details involved in it. According to what the governor publicized, the charter people have 60 days to find a replacement. They should find their own replacement, and they should arrange to sell whatever their equipment is to their replacement that they've chosen. And none of it makes any sense. Oh, wait a minute. It does make sense. It really does. I didn't realize it. We have an election coming up this year. Anytime you have an election coming up, all bets are off. Logic goes out the window. Business goes out the window. What's happening? They're saying that the Charter Time Warner merger was based upon the new company getting new subscribers, or getting two new subscribers in places where subscribers can't have a choice, and giving them a choice for high-speed internet. And now they're saying, of the new subscribers, some 18,000 were in New York City, and they don't count, and therefore we have the new company, Time Warner's replacement, has not gotten to where it was supposed to be, so all bets are off. We're throwing the new contracts out the window, and baloney. Well, that wasn't the word I was going to use, but I thought about what you're saying to me when every time we get off the air with improper language. Well, it is pure baloney. I agree with whoever says I'm not getting good cable service. I agree with them. I'm not using Spectrum myself. I'm using RCN, but they're a small player, and they're latching on to the wires that existed back in the days when Time Warner put them in, and we're still using those same wires. But is this really the problem? The problem that we have with the quality of cable is not that they're not reaching the unknown, unhard-to-reach places out in the boondocks. The problem we have is the quality we get right now is not there. The speed that I get on the internet is a fraction of what people in Europe are getting for a double or triple the price that they're paying. It's the amount of competition that we have is a fraction of the competition in other countries overseas. The quality of the play, I'm not talking about the programming, I'm talking about the technology, it's not there. We're not getting what we pay for. You want to know what's going on? I'll tell you. Check the politics. Who's running against the governor? Where is he having a weak place or a weak follow-through? Who do the unions want? Where are they most powerful or least powerful? It's nothing to do with business. It's all to do with politics. And I don't know about you, but I am totally fed up with politics, totally fed up with politics. And as long as I am, I'm not going to pay too much attention to the headlines. This thing that you're talking about is not going to go through. It'll be dropped once the elections are over. What you just heard, Hank, was my personal opinion. This is Joe King.
In a comeback bid, Radio Shack is now partnering with Hobbytown to sell electronics in 100 U.S. stores. Radio Shack is staging a comeback that will allow it to sell its electronics in more than 100 Hobbytown stores. The partnership with a retail hobby chain will bring Radio Shack back to the suburbs. In 2017, Radio Shack filed for bankruptcy for the second time in a little more than 2 years and survived the proceedings. The 97-year-old toy company is bringing its signature electronics back to stores across America in a new partnership with Hobbytown after emerging from bankruptcy for the second time, but as a shell of its former self late last year. The company, now owned by General Wireless Operations, is installing new Radio Shack Express stores inside 100 Hobbytown locations. The company's announced this just recently. It is the first big move since the consumer electronic chain emerged from the second bankruptcy in 2017, giving it more exposure to many of the suburban markets it had to give up when it shuttered more than 1,000 stores that year. General Wireless bought Radio Shack's assets, including rights to the brand, after the company filed for bankruptcy protection in 2015 and took it through a second bankruptcy in 2017. Left in the dust by other electronics retailers like Best Buy and Amazon, and soured by its partnership with Sprint, Radio Shack is now focusing on e-commerce platform and its 400 dealer locations. It currently sells radios, batteries, consumer electronics and accessories, and electronic component parts. Hey, Marty, do you have any insight on this working partnership with Hobbytown?
Oh, Hank, yes, yet another company is using the Radio Shack name and about to do some expansion. When I was a headquarters exec at Radio Shack, this was under Tandy in the early 1980s, well, the Radio Shack name had already been around for 60 years, and Tandy was the second company to own it. The original Radio Shack began in Boston in 1921 as a store primarily for ham radio operators. The name Radio Shack comes from the little room or shed aboard ships where the radio gear and the radio operator shared small space. And those shipboard radio rooms really only started appearing widely 10 years earlier in the 1910s. So the 1920s, 1930s were a boom era for ham radio, and Radio Shack had some good amateur radio products at attractive prices, and the store grew. In 1939, they started publishing a catalog and picked up nationwide mail order sales. After World War II, as trained radio operators returned to civilian life, bang, there was another boom. By the 1950s, the store was really big in a new trend called hi-fi. But after that, growth slowed. By 1963, the store was nearly bankrupt. That's when Tandy Corp came in and bought the operation. They moved it to Fort Worth and began their own period of aggressive growth. The Radio Shack catalog became the number one leader in third-class mail volume. Company-owned stores and franchise operations mushroomed. At its peak, there were 7,300 Radio Shack stores, almost not quite as many as there were 7-Eleven stores. They sold only private label goods, and that kept on until the cell phone era. At that point, with the Tandy era in decline, their ad slogan was, "You've got questions, we've got answers." But the reality was more limited. I love the former Radio Shack PR guy, Hi Siegel, is a friend of mine. He called and he said, "Hey, have you heard the new slogan?" I said, "Okay, lay it on me." He said, "You've got questions, we've got cell phones." And by then, who didn't? There was a decline. Radio Shack declared bankruptcy in 2015. And in 2015, the name was bought by General Wireless, their third owner, General Wireless, an affiliate of the Standard General Hedge Fund. In 2017, they filed for a second bankruptcy and closed 1,000 of their remaining stores, leaving only 70. Today's store mix includes some online selling through Walmart and Amazon, their own site, for example, plus authorized dealers, plus a new Radio Shack Express operation. It's not big. It's about 500 square feet with a lot of component and connector level products. It's in about 100 locations nationwide. There was news last week that some 50 Hobbytown store locations, that's out of 147 total Hobbytowns, 50 of those locations will now host Radio Shack Express store within a store product areas. I left Radio Shack 35 years ago, and in the time since, I'd like to think I've done my penance. Last week, I took a good look at the current Radio Shack website, where a lot of the products that might have interested me were simply not available, out of stock. The prices were okay, not wonderful. But I'm hoping that the Radio Shack Express growth will come close enough to me to again make Radio Shack what it had once been for me. More or less, the 7-Eleven for electronic component parts that I could run out to fetch and finish my projects without waiting for mail order to arrive. I knew I was sometimes paying up to 100 times more than necessary for those parts, but there's always a time versus money trade-off. Would I shop there again? Probably not, given the current mix of products that really are available. It's been a long slide since the company under Tandy was in the Fortune 200. And for the Tandy era of that, I can't say the slide was undeserved. After all, it's never really about what you want to sell. It's always really about what your customers are or are not interested in buying and how competitive you can be in offering those things. I do wish the new Radio Shack luck, but I think it's going to be uphill for them. Hank?
When we first aired the Personal Computer Radio Show in the early 1980s, we often referred to the bulk eraser Radio Shack sold to quickly and easily demagnetize the information on floppy diskettes. It also worked well for cassette tapes and open tape reels. The realistic Radio Shack audio-video tape bulk eraser then sold for $10. A bulk eraser is a device that uses electromagnetic energy to erase all the data from magnetic disc and tapes. Hopefully, Radio Shack will be able to rediscover this and go back to the future. In February 2018, Election Systems and Software told the press that it had never installed remote access software in any of the e-voting systems it has sold in the various U.S. states or to local governments. In April, the company told Senator Ron Wyden's office, who's the Democrat in Oregon, that it had sold PC Anywhere remote connection software to a small number of customers between 2000 and 2006. The good news about this disclosure is that the systems in question have all been retired and are no longer in use across the United States. But the fact that this happened in the first place, combined with the ongoing warnings about the generally poor state of e-voting security, speaks to the depth and breadth of the issues facing the United States e-voting system as the 2018 midterm election approaches. The fact that ESNS lied about its own previous behavior to the public until pressured by Senator Wyden's office says little good about the civic responsibility these companies feel towards ensuring that voting is handled safely. It's important, just not as important as minimizing any hint of corporate liability. In this case, ESNS installed PC Anywhere software on election management systems, not voting terminals. While EMS hardware doesn't actually collect votes, they typically use to program voting terminals and to tabulate results aggregated from those terminals. In short, compromising an ESM could be even more effective than individual terminals, depending on the nature of the breach and the capabilities of the software. And ESNS notes that none of the ESMs that is sold in this configuration are still operating today. But it's also not the end of the problem, not by a long shot. The United States voting system is heavily atomized and administered at the local level, which means it's mostly run by the Republican Party, since the GOP controls far more counties in the United States than the Democratic Party does. This atomization makes it extremely difficult to change votes as part of a massive coordinated campaign, and is one reason why allegations of vast swaths of illegal votes being cast have never withstood investigation. Any attempt to alter election results within even a single state effectively requires compromising multiple counties across broad geographical areas, to say nothing of the difficulty of coordinating such an attack nationwide. But the fact that the U.S. system is generally resistant to certain kinds of attack doesn't make it perfect against all of them. The atomized nature of our election system also means, for example, that we have absolutely no global standard when it comes to preserving a paper trail of how people vote to ensure that the electronic records can be verified. In a New York Times article written in February, it said that in the 15 years since electronic voting machines were first adopted by many states, numerous reports by computer scientists have shown nearly every make and model to be vulnerable to hacking. The systems were not initially designed with robust security in mind, and even where security features were included, experts have found them to be poorly implemented with glaring holes. This was true in 2016. It remains true as we move into the 2018 midterms. It's not that ESNS has been caught having done something terrible. It's not clear if we understand the differences between a system with a dial-up modem in which the customer initiates the connection with a remote employee and one in which the vendor can make that connection independently. But the company's initial failure to be transparent on this issue is just the latest example of a problem that does date back decades, all the way back in 2006. Ars Technica was documenting massive problems with e-voting machines. Major flaws were still being found in 2015. They're still being found today. It's this fact, more than the question of what ESNS was shipping in 2006, that ought to concern us. Talking about Back to the Future, Classic Shell returns as Classic Start, giving Windows 10 user a proper start menu. When Microsoft scrapped the start menu in Windows 8, users were up in arms and most refused to upgrade to the new OS, which ultimately led to its failure and demise. And of those who did switch, the large numbers sought out third-party start menus. The best of these options, and I've used this one, was unquestionably Classic Shell, a great free tool. It offered users a choice of three different menu styles: Classic, two columns in Windows 7, as well as other options for customizing various elements of the operating system, including Explorer. Yes, it does work on Windows 10. Sadly, the creator of Classic Shell, Ivo Belchev, pulled the plug on this famous creation in December of last year, and this is what he stated. After months of deliberation, I have decided to stop the development of Classic Shell. It was a great adventure for me that lasted 8 fun and exciting years. It started back in 2009 as a simple weekend project, and over time grew to be a hugely popular software brand with many millions of downloads. It was in large part due to all of you, the active Classic Shell community, that reported issues, suggested features, provided translations, developed new skins, and participated in the forum discussions. And he thanks all those who helped and continue the support and encouragement. Before he killed Classic Shell, he made it open source and added it to SourceForge in the hope that someone would fork the project and continue where he left off. And the great news is someone did exactly that. Classic Shell is dead. Say hello to Classic Start. The new version is really just Classic Shell with a new name at the current moment, and it gives you all the options you had previously. Classic Shell, which I've recommended on this show many times, is available from classicshell.net/downloads. Mozilla's Firefox and Google's Chrome are working to reduce the amount of memory and other resources that their browsers use. The browsers impose an increasingly onerous burden on your phone or laptop. Websites are getting bigger, and browsers are getting features that make them more like full-fledged operating systems than just document viewers. So, what is changing? Chrome 68, which was released a few days ago, added a new feature called Page Lifecycle Interface that will let the browser more gracefully pause websites that aren't active and reconstitute them when you need them again. It allows browsers to more aggressively optimize system resources, ultimately benefiting all web users. And Firefox has a project called Fission MemShrink, designed to shave at least 7 megabytes off of each of potentially 100 or more computing processes that the browser uses to draw a website on your screen. It's part of the broader high-profile Fission program to give websites a snappier response in the browser. Computer memory, processing power, and data storage space have been a scarce resource, so every little step to liberate them is important. For one thing, it lets you run more apps and get more performance out of important one, and for another, it can mean your personal computer, tablet, or phone doesn't use as much battery power than it's necessary. Fission MemShrink is designed to reduce memory usage, but it might be a wash since Firefox will use more processes. But those processes deliver performance and security improvements that otherwise would gobble up more memory. Project Fission will result in more responsiveness, and we also expect security benefits from more isolation of different web content. Page Lifecycle adopts a strategy from mobile phones whose underlying operating systems are aggressive about clamping down on apps to preserve resources and protect battery life. If an app isn't being actively used, it might be paused for the good of the system. But Page Lifecycle won't mean an instant fix. For it to work best, web developers will need to support it so browsers can work better to dial back resources when needed. To dial back resources up or down. Page Lifecycle will apply also to progressive web apps, which look more like native apps on smartphones but run atop a browser foundation. That should mean better integration with mobile phones and better performance. We all welcome these changes that is coming up with the browsers. Sometimes it seems like your iPhone or Android phone has completely lost a data connection. This can be fixed by turning off Wi-Fi, since some phones will try to connect to open Wi-Fi networks that aren't actually providing data. If it seems like your phone is constantly dropping a data connection, turn off your Wi-Fi. Let's say you're in Subway Maps or streaming music when suddenly there seems to be no signal. It happens to all of us. There's a chance you simply wander out of a data coverage area. And, well, that's not happening now because it's becoming rare that wireless networks pretty much blanket the United States in high-speed data. Instead, it's more likely that your phone has latched on to some open wireless network that's not providing any service, even if your phone thinks it is. There's a reason for this to happen. Sometimes your wireless network, like AT&T, might have free Wi-Fi hotspots all over the city, but sometimes your smartphone will automatically connect to those networks even if your regular cellular connection has a faster connection. Apple released a fix for this in iOS 11, which was supposed to prevent iPhones from connecting to poor Wi-Fi networks. But this can still sometimes happen on Android and iPhone phones. So the solution is simple. If you're using a Wi-Fi connection, just turn it off and turn it back on again. Give it a try. The smartwatch is a solution looking for a problem. Consider how the wearable business developed. 5 years ago, a collective mania overtook the industry. No one could think of a clear reason why consumers needed an expensive smartwatch when they already had a smartphone in their hand, pocket, or bag. What value could it deliver? A watch simply to replicate features on their phone? But the industry convinced itself that wearables were another platform. And because there were no clear use case for the smartwatch, any use case was considered. As an app platform, smartwatches were found wanting. The display were too small and even more awkward given the round display that many consumers prefer. The small battery capacity was quickly depleted during the course of the day. This was a solution looking for a problem, and an expensive one at that. As a result, many first-wave manufacturers drop out of the market. Meanwhile, dumb, wearable, optimized for health and fitness tracking devices have been selling quite well. But a watch remained a cumbersome and expensive alternative to a tracker. So too did Apple, which revived the watch by adding waterproofing, essentially for swimming and outdoor activity, in its second generation of the Apple Watch. It would be nice to think that Silicon Valley has learned something from this experience, that it doesn't need to shove an expensive chip into everything, or for that matter, to make it smart. And remember, it's always preferable to have a job done rather than just looking smart. Do you really need the next generation smartphone? There's a lull in technological advancement in smartphones. Do you need a new smartphone? You can get a device released last year or even the year before that has most or all of the same essential features released in phones coming this year. A smartphone manufacturer wouldn't release a smartphone unless they had a new model with easy to recognize upgrades compared to its predecessor. But things have changed. It's nobody's fault on their own, really. We've gotten to a place where there's still a lot of profit to be made by smartphone manufacturers, and the way to have that profit is in competition and hype, advertising new features that have no real-world necessity. The difference between a Galaxy S8 and a Galaxy S9 is minimal. The same is true of the iPhone 7 to 8 or even the 8 to the X. Regardless of how different it feels to have a display that covers just a tiny bit more of the front of the device. Here is how most of the public use a smartphone. It's used for browsing the internet in a web browser, playing music with an app, sending and receiving messages, sending and receiving emails, capturing photos and videos, and sharing photos and videos with friends and family. In the past several years, we've reached a place where it's more difficult to find a smartphone with a bad camera than one with a camera that's highly capable of capturing high-quality media. The need for a new smartphone by the average consumer is as follows. A consumer has a smartphone, handles important documents, business, and or personal data on a daily basis, and wants to make sure they've got the most updated security for said data. For those people, a smartphone that's one generation older than the newest model, they're perfectly legit. And it's an option that they just keep the older model. We're in a place very similar to the car industry right in this minute, where the only real good reason to buy a brand new model is because the consumer has money burning a hole in their pocket. Marty's 40-year house design is optimized for the South. But what if he had to build one for somewhere more frigid like Alaska or Antarctica? Or worse, Cleveland, that's where he came from. What tricks might he use to try to be energy miserly, comfortable, and maintenance-free for 40 years in Cleveland? Hey, Marty, tell us what you know and we'll take some notes.
If you're new here, or if when you hear my voice you automatically go to the kitchen for a snack or switch to 10 minutes of an old Dragnet episode, then you may not know that I'm designing and building a proof-of-concept, 40-year maintenance-free, energy-miserly, cybernetic house in South Carolina near Aiken. A lot of the tricks in the design of the house take advantage of being in a warm environment, but what if it weren't? What if we were somewhere positively frigid, like New York, or worse, the Arctic Circle, or even worse, Cleveland? What could I do in the midst of a frost-bitten fantasy to come up with a house that's a little more livable? Well, some of the tricks of the South still work, especially stopping losses through insulation. I've mentioned SIP walls in some long-ago segments. That's S-I-P, SIP. For a structural insulated panel, where there's a manufactured sandwich of several inches of high-density insulating foam between two big, flat, and dimensionally stable engineered boards. I won't explain those boards right now, except to say that these are an evolved and larger form of the kinds of improvements and changes that decades ago plywood brought to lumberyards. That SIP sandwich keeps the indoors and the outdoors very separate without the leaks and thermal bridging of traditionally framed houses, especially when those have all of their insulation from unrolled battens of fluff in the walls. But in the North, we might use SIPs for more than just the walls. We might also use them for the roofing board. Ventilation should be different too. Remember, warmer air rises over cooler air. Cooler air falls below warmer air. In the South, where there are more air conditioning than heating hours, I want the ventilation ducts to come out of registers in the ceiling. But in the North, where it would be hard to push heat all the way to the floor from a ceiling register, we want them in the floor, or at least really low on the wall. That's where those registers should go. Do we need to add heated floors? Well, for the most part, no. Not if we handle the ventilation correctly and do the right kind of flooring insulation. But that's something we may want to consider in the bathroom. The best way to handle that is with recirculating water under the floor, or maybe a more specialized fluid like Dowtherm. We can do some zoning of that. When you step out of the shower, you might want 90 to 95 degrees in the floor. In the lavatory, maybe nothing, or maybe 70 to 75 degrees. In front of the mirrors at the sinks, maybe 75 to 80 degrees. But in every case, a throw rug might be smarter. If we do heat the floors, we'll monitor their temperature with sensors so there's no wasted heat. We may even incorporate pressure sensors so we can localize the heat. But overall, the smartest answer is still throw rugs. What do we do for the HVAC system? Well, the heat pump has a point down around 30 degrees or so. It gets colder than that, it's less effective at heating, and heat needs a boost. Sometimes that's done with a very energy inefficient electric heater panel. Sometimes that's done with gas heat, but gas heat has to be scaled for the whole house because that's the way the code reads. So those heaters are always overkill. You're always overshooting, undershooting, and you're putting the thermometer on a seesaw. A third solution is called hydronic, where you circulate hot water in the chamber, and that is the source of the heat boost that blows through the HVAC ventilation. It's very, very efficient, very effective. Well, we may want to add a second tankless gas water heater in a recirculating arrangement as our source for hydronic heat whenever the temperature drops into or through the 30s or beyond. Depending on when a project in a cold environment would ever happen, it would merit a fresh look at geothermal and other alternatives. In all, it's just too early to call. Is it worth investing in a walk and a driveway that clear themselves of snow? Again, that depends on the approach. In new construction, and especially if we end up doing something geothermal anyway, it might make sense to have a deep-set recirculator pumping Dowtherm under the surfaces of the walks and driveway. But think in moderation. Their target temperature doesn't need to be any higher than 35 degrees. It just has to leave the surface above freezing. Again, embedded sensors communicating to the control system, managing a zoned installation, that's likely to be our best shot at a favorable energy profile. In the south, we use extra deep eaves to create additional shadow time on the windows, reducing the amount of direct solar exposure. In the north, we may want to install the windows with a top about 10 degrees forward of a plumb line as seen from outside. That little bit of an angle can help encourage self-clearing outside and ventilation eddies inside. Most of the electronics stay the same. We may want to permanently mount adaptive holiday lighting to keep from climbing ladders in the snow. Now, by adaptive, I mean RGBW lights that might be red, white, and blue on Independence Day, green on St. Patrick's Day, red on Valentine's Day, red and green at Christmas, lavender at Easter, and deep red when taxes are due. The cold climate lawn sprinklers stay the same, except that the ground moisture sensing and irrigation scheduling will be off for months at a time. The philosophy on both of these is the same. Install it once and let the control system handle it from there. The biggest change in the water system would be installing freeze-proof outdoor spigots. The septic system wouldn't change, at least not the septic system itself, though we may want to grade the exit field to help keep weather-borne water, melting snow, rain, or whatever, from accumulating there. Lightning protection and power distribution would be the same. We would have to make sure that the infrared beam break sensors the driveway don't get blinded by the snow. We can put a temperature or temperature humidity sensor there and then, when necessary, heat them up by running a little power through an adjacent resistor. That should keep them free of snow and defrosted, defogged. We might need to do the same for the bullet cameras that read vehicle license plates and logos. There shouldn't be any problems with the outdoor fans. They're all ceiling fans, so nothing will fall onto them. Then again, we will need to take a close look at the algorithms we use to turn them on and off. The front door address and vanity panel will probably need a small heater and defroster. We'll figure that out. One complication is that we'll need to greatly enhance our comfort algorithms when the fireplace is in use. Since a fireplace's primary heat is hyperzonal, clever manipulation of its temperature, fan speeds, and blower speed should help it become a better orchestrated element of the overall comfort system. Of course, we'll also have to command the usual HVAC system to do a more rapid exchange of that bonus heat into the cold air returns to preheat the air going to the rest of the house. And we'll probably want to adjust any local ceiling fans to a slow stir to help spread the heat in the first place. A gas fireplace, of course, may also become a potentially critical survival element in the event of a power failure if it also happens that for some reason the backup generator is also not running. While advanced thermal designs among the many windows can address many worries in resolving solar impact on the indoors, it's different in colder climates. We'll need to investigate many options in indoor window coverings, things like curtains, shades, or shutters, to determine how to optimize their impact on both comfort and energy bills. And that's assuming, of course, that we're also able to hack their power and control systems. Landscape lights, yard lights, and path lighting, all the outdoor lights will present the same electrical needs in any climate, but the geometry may have to change to accommodate likely depths of snow. Now, these are just some first thoughts. I don't think I have the energy to build two houses at once, but I do have friends in Cleveland who may want to talk me into it someday. And if they really start to nag me about it, I'll have to tell them what Hank and I keep telling you. Back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut tri-state region. Westchester PC User Group will have a presentation on cloud tools, which includes Dropbox, BoxSync, and Google Drive, Thursday, August the 2nd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York. Danbury Area Computer Society, Tuesday, August the 7th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and they meet at the Danbury Hospital Creasy Auditorium at 24 Hospital Avenue in Danbury, Connecticut. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on organizing your media files and how to back them up. Thursday, August the 9th, meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, August the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall in New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury, New York, on the Old Westbury campus. Brookdale Computer User Group will be meeting Thursday, August the 23rd at 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Lodge Community Room in Middletown Township Public Library at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC User Group will have their general meeting Tuesday, August the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Community Room at the Princeton Public Library, located at 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting on Friday, September the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need some technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. Just remember, there is no such thing as a dumb question. And I have the following advice for computer club announcements. All the relevant information should be on the same page, preferably on the home page. And the computer club announcement should have the following: the name of the club, topic of presentation, if any, day of week, and the date of meeting and time, the venue of the meeting, and the location of the venue. Hey, we'll be seeing you at these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, it's essential you back up. Just remember, three things you have to do: back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.